Thank you, Pierre. Yes, so I see, you know, there are many repeat visitors here. So most of you, I think, were in the BioActors program last spring when I was here for the wave flows problem. So anyway, this talk is definitely, I think, going to be rather the odd man out in your program, from what I can see of your program. And Pierre requested that this be pedagogic. I worry it may be too pedagogic, but, you know, please pipe up. So, talk about avalanches in confined plasmas. And I will give you a very brief primer on tokamak turbulence and transport, which is the physical system that motivates this. And then I'll talk at some length about avalanches and turbulent transport, which is basically a revisitation of the sand pile type of problem, but with some kind of an interesting way of looking at this. Talk very briefly about zonal flows, which are a kind of competing secondary pattern, and then talk about staircases and jam formation. And so that's kind of the plan. So first, what is a tokamak? And I don't mean to be doing any advertising for the fusion program, but just so you get the idea. So I was in Korea last week, so it's very easy to get a picture of the so-called K-star tokamak, one of the two superconducting tokamaks in the world. But the basic idea is, you know, it's a donut-shaped plasma confinement device with a very strong toroidal field, also carries a quite hefty toroidal current that produces a strong colloidal field, has an aspect ratio running about 3 or so. And as you can see, the size of these goodies is such that it puts quite a dent on the science budget's bank account. And the other thing that maybe a message you should get from the general propaganda is that there is enough of a jump from the present-day generation of experiments to the, you know, the some would say monstrosity of ITER, you know, that's under construction in the south of France.
What?
Well, I mean, this would be looking at a slice through the donut. So this, right, so this, the donut would be coming this way. So this would be the axis, the distance from the axis of symmetry. So crudely put, that's the radial direction, colloidal and toroidal going round. Okay? So as you can see, it's, you know, it's a factor of 20 or so. So there is a great deal of concern in some sense, predictive understanding of transport. The other comment I would make is that the strong magnetization in the system effectively renders it quasi-two-dimensional so far as the turbulence dynamics goes. And that's a theme that will be coming up. And that is a cartoon of ITER. And the name of the game is energy confinement. And if you just ask what is required for ignition, right? So, I mean, you basically, it's a game of balancing the fusion power, which goes as n squared t squared, which you can write as the square of a dimensionless parameter, the plasma beta, the ratio of thermal to magnetic pressure, times the magnetic field to the fourth. So you notice here we have a dimensionless ratio, which is limited by stability physics, and here we have an engineering quantity. And this thing has to effectively beat, this is the rate of power production, has to beat the loss, which is just NT divided by energy confinement time, and bingo appears the Lawson criterion, which I'm sure you've all heard about. And the point of this little digression is, of course, to emphasize the great importance of energy confinement and transport in kind of playing a determining role in the problem. So the question then is, how do you determine the energy confinement time, and how do plasmas form, how do they form a profile, and what limits the gradients, and then how do the gradients relax? And that, of course, is where ideas from games with sand piles appear.
And so could you remind what is the plasma inside, and what kind of
it is a basic, you can think of it at most of these plasmas are electron deuteron plasmas, but for if it's, you know, you can just think of it as electron proton plasma. Okay, there is generally it is a gaseous, very weakly coupled plasma, nothing about as far from a solid as you can get. The other comment is there is a small population of impurities. You have too many impurities and you have severe problems. But for the purposes of a basic, that's important. The impurities are important technically because impurity gradients can actually do things in terms of driving instabilities and all. But
impurities are of other atoms?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Crud, for an example, stuff from the walls coming bouncing in. Low Z impurities you can live with, high Z impurities radiate, which is, and then you have, that's very bad news. But that, for the purposes of this discussion, we don't have to worry about that. Any other questions on basic issues?
So they are protons and they are deuterons?
Deuterons. Well, I mean, 2-to-1. I mean, you have to have an electrically, the plasma is quasi-neutral, so you have charge-neutral plasma, so that's it. It's in terms of the gaseous and electrical properties, it's very simple. Okay, so, you know, this again would be a slice, and this is a very bad picture, but I don't know, this came out lopsided, but you might have, let's see if I can, is there some chalk here? So generally, you know, temperature profiles, again, which is, you know, if you're basically interested in keeping the heat in, that means you want a temperature profile that's nicely peaked and steep, okay? And so they generally look something like this. And, all right, so I think I'm gonna drive you nuts. I'll try not to do that, just to be clear. But, you know, you have an environment with a strong magnetic field out of the plane. So you have basically the turbulence that's going to be sitting in here is going to be kind of weak or wave turbulence. It is rather different from high Reynolds number Navier-Stokes turbulence. Because of the fact that these are actually quite collisionless plasmas, it's not even particularly meaningful to define a Reynolds number in the conventional sense as a measure of the strength of say excitation, because the relevant damping is Landau damping rather than say viscosity or something like that. One point I would make is, however, that in the spirit of kind of modest strength turbulence, a very useful point is the Kubo number is sitting basically around unity, maybe slightly less. So you have the Kubo number being, I'm sorry, Pierre, I'm gonna drive you. Maybe just leave the lights on. It won't kill you. Where's the switch over here? So the Kubo number being the ratio of a typical velocity times a correlation time to a spatial correlation length. Because it's strongly magnetized, the typical velocities on that subject are E cross B velocities. the things that drive the turbulence are the local temperature and density gradients, okay? For those of you who may have some familiarity with this type of system, the fluctuations are very similar to thermal Rossby waves that you might have encountered in planetary atmospheres, with the key point difference that the buoyancy due to gravity is replaced effectively by buoyancy due to magnetic curvature. In other words, you can think of the motion of charged particles along curved field lines makes an effective gravitational force. Yeah.
So even though you don't have many collisions, these TE, TI are well defined.
It's a matter of time scales. You do have collisions, you don't have collisions on the time scale of the fluctuations. In other words, the background profiles are, there are certainly enough collisions to make a temperature well defined. It's just that the time scale of the instabilities is relatively fast compared to a collision frequency, okay? What other points? The other point is, and this is very important to make connection with things like sand piles, is that the fluctuations are strongly localized by the structure of the magnetic field. Now again, remember you have a donut-shaped system, so you have periodicity both toroidally and poloidally, and you have magnetic fields both toroidally and poloidally, so basically the fluctuations tend to sit where their wave vector dot the magnetic field is zero. In other words, where their projection on the magnetic field is zero. And the reason for this is this keeps K parallel down, and by keeping K parallel down, you keep Landau damping down. In other words, Landau damping is basically wave particle resonance between a fluctuation of finite frequency and then the particle motion along the magnetic field. So it says you're going to have most efficient growth of things where K dot B is equal to zero. This is particularly important for kind of making connection because it tells you that you have a state of kind of pinned turbulence. In other words, you have an ensemble of modes bubbling along, but they are more or less held fixed in their spatial position. And you have an array of these scatterers, but they don't kind of get up and sweep through the box as you might be familiar with kind of usual convection. And of course, the idea of an array of pinned scatterers then plays very much to the model with the idea of a sand pile.
So what would be a Coupon number for strong turbulence? If the Coupon number is a measure of the turbulence, what is strong?
Well, no, I mean, I would say, well, that's not quite what the Kubo number is a measure of. The Kubo number is a measure of the degree of memory. In other words, it is put another way, it's the number of kicks in a correlation length. So a small Kubo number means you have many kicks in a correlation length and you've got a diffusion process. A large Kubo number means you blast through it in kind of one kick and you have really more like a percolative process, okay? So typically the Kubo numbers in our system run, depending on the nasty details, they run less than two order unity. So the kind of usual kind of diffusive kind of closure tricks that we all know and love work to a point. Of course, when it reaches unity, you're in the soup, and that's, of course, where reality often sits. But you don't have, what we don't have is large Kubo number regime where you have kind of scattering with a lot of memory. Okay? I mean, interestingly, the measured fluctuation levels, in other words, it's very difficult, as we were discussing with Karen, that before to actually measure avalanches in experiments, but there's been a ton of studies of turbulence, and certainly the Kubo numbers observed in the experiments uniformly sit around order unity. Yes?
Going back to this Kubo number with regard to fluids, normally, you know, we talk about hydrodynamic behavior versus kinetic behavior, conservation fluid dynamics versus kinetic theory. There, the Linear path of the fluctuations compared to the Linear path of collisions. That's a measure. So it sounds to me, when you say Kubo number is typically one, that's a difficult regime. It seems to me it's comparable to that. The free path of fluctuation is comparable to the free path of the collisions. That's when things get tricky.
Well, but let's be a little careful here. There's the issue of, I see what you're getting at, and that's a way to think about Kubo number, but you have a very anisotropic problem. In other words, the particles can only free stream, say, along the magnetic field, let's say the toroidal direction. So the question of collisionality score is kept in that the long way around. The Kubo number, what I was, or should have, is really a measure of radial scattering, okay? So you don't really, what's going on here is the turbulence scattering due to E cross B drift, not collisions. So you have a situation where you have low collisionality and long mean free path along the magnetic field, but Kubo number order unity for radial scattering. So you have to kind of keep that dichotomy in mind.
What is delta in that equation?
Excuse me?
What is delta in that equation?
Delta?
Yeah.
This would be, say, the radial correlation length of one of these modes that is doing the scattering. I mean, you can think of, you know, ensemble of this thing, and it will come to that. But if you want another interesting point about this system is that it has a characteristic small scale, namely a gyro radius, right? So the delta would be a few gyro radii. One of the key small parameters in these systems, and you realize if you're going to play a sand pile game, you need in some sense to have, you know, many scatterers across the length of the box, right? To create an environment of something with many cells. So you need many scatterers in the system, and that all points toward a key small parameter is the ratio of rho I, the gyro radius, to the system size, which is very small. And as you will see, the smallness of that parameter is why these things destroy the science budget, because it basically says bigger is better, which we'll come to in the next view graph. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? You're asking the right questions, I think. Yeah. Excuse me. The answer is yes. In fact, it's actually worse than that. Let me see. Hold that thought. Ding, ding, ding. Let me go back. No, I'll bring it up here. You have, again, where's the eraser? So you have three classes of scales, right? So you have macro and micro, and micro was the scale delta of a few rho I that we were talking about. macro is the system size, the minor radius, and then, of course, as always in these kinds of games, there is a meso range in between. And the answer to your question, Pierre, is that you have electric fields on all types of scales. Okay, you have a mean radial electric field on the macroscopic scale that is tied to the equilibrium quantities. You have the fluctuating electric field, which in both r and theta, which produces the advection that drives with the instabilities, and then you have a mesoscopic electric field, which is associated both with cell structures extended radially, which you might relate to avalanches, and also very importantly to zonal flows that have to compete against avalanches. So it's a delightful situation. It is, of course, the whole mesoscopic, you know, the separation of the few gyroradii from the system size is what defines the mesoscopic domain, which then is of course, where all the fun with avalanching occurs. Okay, any others?
One last. Are you in a regime of magnetohydrodynamic turbulence?
I'd have to find some other way to make a living if it was MHT turbulence. There are fusion, when something called a major disruption occurs, the answer to your question becomes yes, but you can guess from the word major disruption, that's not good. In general, fluctuations, you can think of them as thermal Rossby waves. If you want to make contact with MHD in some simple terms, it's really weaker than that. You know, you can go back, say, if you take, you know, the usual, say, E plus B cross B over C minus grad P is equal to A to J. So, and you just take the parallel components, so you have E parallel is equal to A to J parallel, and then you also have the del parallel P. I may have got the sign wrong, but who cares? The usual thing in MHC is forget the pressure, and you balance these two, of course. In these systems, the dominant balance is between the parallel electric field and the parallel pressure gradient, and this immediately leads us to a kind of Boltzmann equation, where the density fluctuation tracks the potential fluctuation. So it's kind of the opposite limit from MHD.
What's eta?
Eta
is the resistivity?
Eta would be the resistivity, yes. Yes.
And is one actually relativistic or classical?
Oh, this is all classical. Things haven't gotten quite so. Only runaways. I mean, you do have a situation where if you're not careful with how you ramp the current up, you can make a population of ultra, you know, high velocity electrons that becomes relativistic, and then you have to worry about that. But that's again. All right. Okay, good. So we have to have the obligatory computer pictures. These, let me kill the lights. So these are kind of just to give you an idea of what the fluctuations are. These basically are kind of linear modes you're seeing, but you see the idea of a kind of extended filaments, right, going along the magnetic field, twisting with the field. And if you look at the projection, say, in a cut through the donut, these filaments will make what amounts to large-scale eddies. And you'll notice these, of course, have not started doing anything interesting like interacting, but you notice that these eddies can extend appreciable differences. Of course, these things will not survive the onset of nonlinearity. But the way to think of it is kind of extended, quasi 2D filaments, right? Where all the interesting stuff is in the two dimensions of the r theta plane.
So the color code is
The color code would be here. Would be what is it? It would be magnitude of the fluctuation. So red is clearly high and blue is lower. The other interesting thing you will recall, I mentioned that these things are driven by magnetic curvature replacing gravity. So you'll notice the fluctuations are much stronger on the outside than the inside. Okay, and that's a reflection of the unfavorable curvature on the outside. Okay, so you see the buoyancy effect in action.
But there's no net current somehow going around.
Oh, well, there is a toroidal current because that produces the poloidal magnetic field.
But not the blue-red stuff is moving actually globally, no?
Excuse me?
The stuff that you're... I mean, the plasma is not moving globally.
You're asking, is the plasma rotating?
Yes.
And the answer is yes. Okay, but the question is, it doesn't rotate. By the way, a very interesting question in the field, since you ask, is there is a kind of what's called an intrinsic rotation. In other words, there is a rotation observed in the absence of any torque. Okay, and there is a kind of dynamo process at work in the system. In other words, it's a kind of a Reynolds stress-driven flow. There's a symmetry breaking, and the heat flux is converted, just as, you know, the convection in the sun drives differential rotation on the surface of the sun. The same kind of game is played out here, and it produces this toroidal rotation, and you can get a net spin-up, because you can kick out some momentum at the boundary. Now, however, usually you don't have to go to this extent, because one of the ways to heat the plasma is to basically shoot a neutral beam at it. Okay, and that is a momentum source, and then the whole thing would be rotating like gangbusters.
So, the fluctuations you're referring to is just, if I sit at one place, what the
Well, I mean, you will have, they sit in one place, but they kind of wiggle back and forth, right? And they beat against density and temperature perturbations, also wiggling up and down to produce a net slower flux. Okay?
So the fluctuation isn't which one?
The fluctuation in the simplest possible picture, the fluctuation is in the electric field and in the temperature and density. Okay. The magnetic field you can regard as fixed. When you go to higher plasma pressure, you have to start worrying about magnetic fluctuations. All right? So kind of this, we've already talked about some of this, but maybe now you get the picture. So the critical point in this game, and here's the profile we're trying to explain, is we have two scales, a small one on the gyro radius, a large one on the cross section. And this defines a rather key dimensionless ratio, what we call rho star, ratio of gyro radius to A. And this, of course, the smallness of this quantity is, you know, can be a few percent in current days, I mean, even lower than that, and for something like ITER down to 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 4. So this is really what allows starting to think in terms of avalanching and so forth. So to review, the drivers are the temperature and density gradients. So you can just think of thermal buoyancy if it helped, but again, due to magnetic curvature and peakedness of the temperature profile, and there's a kind of criterion on the peakedness, which is kind of conceptually similar to the Rayleigh criterion in fluids, except of course it is a flux-driven rather than a boundary-driven driven process, because you have basically the heating puts a certain amount of heat in the middle, and the turbulence has to dispose of the heat by transport. So you have quasi-2D elongated cells along B, characteristic scale of a few gyro radius. Characteristic velocity is the diamagnetic velocity, which is our friend rho star times the speed of sound. So at the level of dimensional analysis, you know, the diffusivity would just be, you know, at the level of mixing length theory, courtesy of Mr. Prandtl, the diffusivity would just be rho times the characteristic velocity, which would be rho star times Bohm diffusion, Bohm being T over B. So this, you know, this is why ITER is so big, right? Because this is saying, you know, bigger is better. I can make a lower diffusivity by making a bigger device that drops rho star, right? That's the essence. So that's the essence of the argument. And a bigger device has more favorable confinement. The interesting thing, in reality, the gain with size is not as great as you would like. In other words, if you insist on keeping score in terms of a diffusivity, by the way, I should tell you that very much kind of hardwired into the data analysis, and in both the hardware and the software, and I might add the wetware, of the field is the idea that all transport is a diffusion process, okay? And the data is analyzed in this picture. In other words, people ask, what's the diffusivity, you know? So the theorists go around and talk about things like fractional kinetics and Levy flights and so forth, but this, somehow when the data is analyzed in terms of diffusion coefficients, it's hard to break in. But in that kind of framework, the thing that comes out is the diffusivity has a significantly weaker scaling with rho star than unity. And this is a tip-off. You'll note, by the way, of course, that if there was no small scale present, the diffusivity would be Bohm, and it would be that you could make the thing as big as you like and you get the same result. So this is the tip off that somehow the system is doing something that is beating the small scale a bit, and that's where the avalanche comes in. Well, I mean, the answer is probably yes. In other words, from the point of view of what one would expect, and also from computer simulations, which we're coming to, basically the transport is not diffusive. In other words, instead of a critical exponent of a half, it's more something of order unity. So you get these ballistic pulses, and you get these, that's the idea of the avalanche, right? Certainly if avalanching, right, it's sort of correlated toppling or interaction of cells sort of bursting across a range of mesoscales, that's something you would not describe as fundamentally in a diffusion picture, right? You could shoehorn it into that, but that's not really right.
But there could be a longer time scale over which a diffusion
is. Yeah, but I mean, that maybe the longer, that's the question is whether the relevant time scale for losing the heat is. All right. So how am I doing on time? I may have to skip some stuff.
Because the cutoff is good.
What?
Half an hour, maybe let's say 40 minutes more.
All right, so maybe I skip some of this, following your advice. So let's.
Can you remind us what is the final goal actually? What would you want to achieve? That there is as little transport as possible? Or...
Well, the answer is you would like certainly to, it's a very interesting question. The problem is it could keep us here all day. I mean, in some sense, the answer is we thought that was the answer. Okay, in other words, sort of 30 years ago, there was discovered a kind of bifurcation, a kind of spontaneous bifurcation in the transport and turbulent processes that effectively turned off the turbulence, okay, and produced transport barriers at the boundaries, so-called H mode. And this was a case, it just over a small region at least produced a transport barrier and did exactly what you said, it make as little transport as you like. This has proven to have certain problems. In other words, it leads to impurity accumulation, it leads to, if you want to actually build something, it leads to very high heat loads where the magnetic field comes against the wall and so forth. So what you really want is you want to keep the turbulence down, but you want to be able to kind of control it and turn it up and down. It helps to have a certain amount of turbulence to control impurities, ash, and various other things. You don't want a completely quiescent state, because what will happen is, there's several classes of instabilities in these things. If you have a quiescent state, the mean gradients will grow until they start to challenge very simple MHD stability limits. And like this gentleman was asking a while ago, and remember my name for that, disruption, right? So that's not good. So you want to be able to control the turbulence. And what has happened is in the past 30 years, we've gone to the state of being able to turn it off and now realizing we want it back. And one of the main focus of the World Fusion Program now is in some sense trying to live with this state of reduced turbulence. A complicated problem. Anyway, avalanches. So one thing that should be clear is that this problem, is begging to be thought of in terms of games with avalanches and sand piles. So here we have a kind of a table of correspondences between turbulent transport in a toroidal plasma and our, for sand pile model. Okay, and so you can think of a localized fluctuation as some kind of cell or instability, and this would correspond to a grid site, which would be the analog of a local cell, okay? The local turbulence dynamics then, of course, defines the automata rules, and of course the local gradient for instability maps into the critical sandpile slope for toppling. The degree of local eddy-induced transport corresponds to the number of grains moved if you hit the stability limit. The total energy or particle content maps to the total number of grains, the total mass. The heating noise, you know, you'll have input into the system. That input is, of course, noisy, so the heating noise and the background fluctuations map to the proverbial random sprinkling of grains, and you could, that would, of course, not be random across the whole pile, but there would be a kind of profile on it because deposition is tailored. The energy or particle flux would correspond to the sand flux. The mean temperature and density profiles would correspond to the average slope of a sand pile. And what we might call a transport event then, of course, becomes an avalanche. And I didn't talk too much about it, but we'll maybe come back to it in a while. You, a very important player in this is the question of these sheared flows on meso and macro scales, and these become a sheared wind in the pile. So this then, you know, and of course the disparity between rho I and A is what allows you to get many cells in the pile and allows you basically to play this game, okay? So that's the kind of correspondence. It becomes a very useful toy, and it's actually better than it looks because I haven't had time to tell you everything. So now, to actually see avalanches in even a computer simulation, okay, it's very important that you have a flux-driven simulation. In other words, a simulation where you have a source, say, of heat or whatever, and you have losses at the boundary, and where the mean profile gets to adjust and perhaps oscillate or do whatever it does along the way. I make this point because because of this large range of scales in the system, many of the bread and butter simulation codes in the business play games with tweaking or freezing or adaptively evolving the background gradients. And when they do that, they immediately lose any information about avalanching. So there's been now quite a number of studies with different types of codes. And it's interesting, here you have kind of a study of the spectrum of flips from a sand pile type model. I mean, you know, you've seen corresponding things ad nauseum in the self-organized criticality business. And then, you know, you see basically the characteristic 1 over F region, then a steeper region, and the usual thing sort of dribbling off to nothing for the large events. Now, here we have the spectrum of the flux, right? So Q sub omega square is the spectrum of the flux from a simulation that actually solves a reduced form of the Boltzmann equation, something called the gyrokinetic equation, which kind of averages over the fast time scale of the gyro motion. And I think, but the point you should get is the amazing similarity of the flux spectrum and the sand pile. You see again, basically a kind of a very clear 1 over F region, a drop off as you go to higher frequency and smaller scales where you're on the small scale end of the mesoscale and sort of a rollover on large scales. So that's, I think, one of the more compelling demonstrations for the utility of these kind of avalanche pictures of what's going on. And of course, the presence of this population of things with this type of scaling does not sit well with diffusive modeling. Basically, for 40, 50 years, the bread and butter of the way things are done in this business is this procedure called quasi-linear theory, which is nothing more than standard mean field theory using this kind of iterating the linear response. And that probably it is very far gone from reality. And of course, that of course is what leads to the use of diffusion modeling in the data analysis. So they basically, the message is that avalanches happen. So to go a little further, here we have, and this is, if Karen was asking me, can you actually see these in experiments? In tokamak experiments, they're very hard to see. The reason being is that it's very hard to measure fluctuating electric fields inside the device. You can measure them at the boundary by sticking in a Langmuir probe, but that isn't particularly useful. Also, if the tokamak is hot, your probe will melt, however pathetically shallow the penetration. So in smaller experiments, the problem is you don't have so much of a separation of scale between the gyro radius and the system size. So in some sense, avalanching is more relevant in large experiments, so that then drives us to the computer. But here we have another kind of a picture. You know, notice this is time and this is space, and these red contours, you can see that the fact that these are tilted. These are these tongues here are the propagating avalanches heading out, and kind of you see the irregular bursts reflecting the intermittent or bursty character of the process. The other interesting thing is, of course, you have a kind of two-way propagation. That's from a computer simulation. Turns out, we'll come back to this later, that the transport, rather than being fit by a Fick's law, is better fit by a heat flux law with a non-local kernel. So rather than Q equal chi grad T, Q is better fit by a kind of kappa of R and R prime, grad T of R prime. And as you can guess, we'll come back on this more later, but basically kappa is not square integrable. In other words, so the second moment of kappa doesn't exist, which is, of course, the tip-off of the breakdown of Fokker-Planck theory. And the other thing, just to basically the kernel, the typical scale associated with the kernel is very large compared to the correlation length of the fluctuations, establishing a very clear separation of scales between the avalanche and the fluctuation size. So the avalanche consists of some number, say in this particular numerical experiment, was sort of on the order of five eddies overturning, so sort of kicks on the order of that number, and there's a very clear separation in scale. Okay.
What is plottable?
Excuse me.
The Q or T? What is plottable?
This is kernel width.
On the top.
This is time and this is space and the color is Q. That's the intensity of the heat flux. Okay. So basically these tongues are tongues of heat that are really kind of avalanches bursting outward. Yes, sir.
Now in terms of these basic ingredients of the fluid and Hooper number or anything, what is it that makes avalanches occur? Take a general lesson of what you're trying to.
What makes it occur?
I mean, yeah.
Because you are dealing with a system where you have many neighboring fluctuations, gradient driven, right, local gradient driven, that are sitting there, and you have a situation you have a system that's hovering near marginality. So then when you deposit, say, some slug of heat that drives the gradient locally above the threshold, causes an overturning, and bingo, 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 like the old kind of toppling of dominoes.
Right. Why is the system hovering near marginality?
Well, the answer is that if put another way, even if you were to do say quasi-linear theory or whatever, and you were to actually calculate the transport is highly nonlinear in the deviation from marginality. Okay, in other words, by any way you estimate things, if you were to put source is equal to the divergence of a flux, that flux it depends strongly on grad T minus grad T crit, and if you were to solve for grad T minus grad T crit, it's going to be a fractional power of the source strength. So it's sitting close. We're coming to it. Okay.
Because there are only 20 minutes left for the
solution. All right, well, there are many things, many things to show. Yeah.
But I see you have a nice one. Thanks.
Okay, so.
Yeah, okay.
We should go on.
All right, are you, as long as we went this far, are you okay? Or? All right.
I thought the question was, is there some knob that you can tell?
Well, well, the answer is there are many knobs, okay? Now let's skip this. So one very simple thing, which goes back actually to Juan Cardor, I suspect you guys are quite familiar with this happy paper, and we push this ahead a bit. But just to review the basics, if you wanted to build a kind of simple model for these sorts of things, you can kind of steal some of their ideas. And basically, the heat balance equation, right, for if delta T is the deviation from the critical or self-organized profile, as we were talking about before, you have a conserved order parameter outside the region of deposition, right? So your source is locally defined, and you have a sink at the boundary, and beyond that you have a conserved order parameter. So the question is, how do you define the heat flux? So a very useful way for playing this game is to use this trick of basically requiring that the story be invariant under reflections of the deviation of the size of the perturbation, and say x goes to minus x going down the pile. So the basic gist of this is that bumps go down and voids go up, and that if you flip the directions or flip the sign of the bump and voids, you get the same thing. And this immediately drives us to something like a Berger's equation, right? The lowest order non-trivial model gives you a Berger's equation, where the business end is of course this thing delta T d by dx delta T, and I like to think of this as basically a case, as representing the fact, going back to your question, that in some sense the transport is in fact a process that is increases with the fluctuation delta T, so the overall flux then goes as delta T squared. So this is reflecting the kind of dependence we were discussing a minute ago. And, well, I don't know if we're ever going to get there, but one can push this a bit further. And these things, of course, then immediately give you some basic ideas that gives you the characteristic exponents. It shows the 1 over F scaling, shows the kind of ballistic propagation scaling. And you can use these kinds of models to analyze the simulation data, and it works extremely well. Now, you were asking about control parameters. One other thing I think I should mention is these improved confinement regimes, say, as you were talking about. In other words, where you kind of kill things. These are characterized by the presence of a shear flow. So one of the interesting things that kind of we have been driven to study is to revisit the time-honored problem of the sand pile in the presence of a region where there is a shear flow, at first just externally prescribed across the pile. Okay? So it's very interesting here. Again, space and time, you see the usual avalanches, and with the shear flow, you see, of course, immediately the destruction of the large avalanches, a kind of randomization and breakup in the in between. And by the way, that sheared flow can be produced by any one of a number of means, among one of which is to, remember I said you heat the device by injection of momentum, but if you could arrange to have sufficiently kind of a momentum source with a sufficiently strong localization, this will produce a shear flow and will in fact produce this sort of thing.
So this is a localized shear flow.
Exactly.
So shear band.
Yeah, exactly. The interesting thing is you put the shear band in, and if you go back to the avalanche spectrum, you notice you basically kind of destroy the large ones. You get, of course, an increase at the very small scales, but it's not clear that it matters. So one thing this tells you very clearly, that one way to control the avalanching is to induce the formation of shear flows. Okay, and these have a very strong effect, an order of magnitude or more, on both the 1 over F range and the large avalanche range. Now, so let me skip this, because let me say briefly, there, to kind of come to one of the more interesting things. Another player in this, in addition to avalanches, is zonal flows. Okay, we haven't talked about that. In other words, self-consistently emerging flows in the system. And you might ask, why is that? Well, the tokamak plasma is embarrassingly like a planetary atmosphere. In other words, it is a system with a small Rossby number, where instead of rotation, it is the Larmor frequency, the strong magnetic field that enforces the two-dimensionality. Okay, so immediately, as I said, the analog of the type of fluctuations that are thermal Rossby waves, which are exactly what goes on here, which what produces the band structures. The upshot of this is, and Pierre told me don't get into all this, so I won't, is you really have, in addition to any external shear flow, you have a population of self-driven internal shear flows. So in addition to the drift waves, which is the buzzword for the instability, you have this kind of zonal flows. The Reynolds stresses, or momentum transport due to the drift waves, drives the zonal flows. And of course, the zonal flows produce a shear that back reacts on the underlying drift waves. And you can, by playing games, say, with modulational instability and wave kinetics, where spectral transport equations, or all you good condensed matter physicists familiar with this, you can build up a system which has a structure rather similar to our beloved dynamical system of the predator and the prey, where the drift waves are the prey and the zonal flows are the predator. And you have a self-regulating system which is controlled by the flow damping and the sources to a large extent. And without going too much further on that, this begs the central question. In some sense, there are two, you know, in the language of pattern formation, there are two secondary patterns emerging in this story. One is what we have talked about, namely the avalanche, which is stochastic and induces extended transport, right? The other is this beastie, the zonal flow, which is quasi-coherent, and it in fact regulates transport by shearing. So the question is, how do these two interact?
So right? If I'm understanding it correctly, so then the zonal flow will break up the avalanche.
Exactly.
The avalanche is because it creates localized shearing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the question is,
it's a self-regulating some kind.
Well, you have a pattern competition.
Yeah.
Right? And the question is, who wins? Right? This is, to me, the scientific question, in terms of this system. Well, indications are that, they coexist, but kind of by a phase separation, which brings us to the staircase. Okay? And the stair... Basically, here we'll skip this. So, the interesting thing, right, so the question, I think you understand quite well. How do these two competing patterns kind of coexist? And the answer is they coexist by separating into different regions, which brings us to what we like to call the E cross B staircase. And this is from a computer simulation. And the upshot here is the following. You will note that, here we see an array of E cross B shear layers, rather evenly spaced and quite coherent, sitting there. And the pair of colors means it's going one way on one side and the opposite way on the other side. So where you have strong shear, you ought to have a steepening of the gradient, right? Because the temperature gradient that drives the turbulence, because the shear is going to be breaking up any avalanching or whatever else going on. And if you plot this 1 over LT, 1 over the gradient scale length, you see sitting at the shear layers, there is a peak in the gradient scale length, indicating that co-located with the shear layers are corrugations in the profile, okay? In between these neighboring corrugations, you have the usual ensemble of avalanches. Okay, so what happens, in a kind of quick bottom line kind of summary is what happens is the two, the two populations coexist by separating from each other. In other words, the shears are concentrated in narrow band and the avalanches live in between the shear layers. And this lattice of layers is the staircase, and the step size of the staircase sets the outer scale of the avalanche distribution, which is a question. In other words, the question that must have been on your mind is there an emergent mesoscale at some point? And the answer is yes, and it's the step size. Okay? So that's the basic gist. And better. How am I doing on time, Sam?
You have 10 more minutes.
No, 10 more minutes. Well, I'm doing the best we can. So, by the way, in between the steps, you have the usual non-local kernel. And the kernel is very closely approximated by a Lorentzian. This is what I was saying before. You notice the second moment of that is divergent. And the question is then, how do you form the staircase? Okay. And let me skip this. And this brings us to a kind of an interesting little model. And the idea is the staircase One way of looking at the formation of the staircases is by the formation of jams in the ensemble of heat avalanches. Okay, so the idea is that you can going back to the kind of continuum model that we talked about before, one tries to look for the onset of jams. And I remember in yesterday's talk, there was a great point made about the importance of memory in avalanche processes, and it's the same element continues in today's talk. The critical element of memory that is required for this is the time delay between the heat flux and the temperature perturbation, right? And that time delay is closely akin to the driver's response time in a traffic flow. So of course, one sure way to get a traffic jam is to get all the drivers drunk and get their response time nice as long, and I think everything else takes care of itself. So basically, the idea here is to, you know, one of these great books, I think, you know, is the book Linear and Nonlinear Waves by Jerry Widom. Always great fun to use in teaching, and a very nice discussion of how you would basic ideas of traffic flow, and in particular how jams form. And you know, you can write down a continuum model where you have an adjustment of the flow to some V is a function of density on some time scale tau, which is a reaction time. And when that reaction time is sufficiently long, the effective diffusivity of the car density goes negative, you get a clustering instability, and you get an array of nonlinear structures or kind of shock-like structures, which have been rather colorfully named jamatons, a play on the word solitons in the traffic flow literature.
So is it very different from the shock-like structures you get in the Burgers equation?
Oh, yes. Yes. No, because the Burgers equation in the simple Burgers never has a negative diffusivity. Right? That's a very key thing. So the question here is, well, this we mentioned, so going beyond this model, what we need is to think about where delay times have gone. And it is actually the case that rather than putting the heat flux equal, say, the heat flux determined by, say, the mean field heat flux determined by symmetry arguments as done by Juan Cardar, if you look deeper at the underlying kinetic equation, you get something that is rather close to the Geyer-Krumhansel type of rule, which is basically pointing toward a relaxation on a time scale, where the time scale is related to the characteristic mixing time of the turbulence, when the relaxation goes toward the mean field case. The upshot of this is that our friend Berger's equation from before, from Juan Cardar, now becomes what amounts to a telegraph equation. You'll note the appearance of the second derivative in time there from the finite time delay. And it is, of course, a nonlinear telegraph equation because the Berger's nonlinearity persists here. Okay, so that is, and this type of model then, you realize immediately has two types of fluctuations in it. It has pulses, like in Berger's equation, and it also has waves. And you get, if you ask when does the pulse overtake the wave, That defines then the formation of the jam. And I will show very, very directly that at that point, if you do it in a perturbative analysis, is when the effective diffusivity goes negative, you get a clustering instability, and you get a jam. And that's the kind of the quick one-line summary of the story. The TAW is not wishful thinking. By the way, I trust it's obvious that the analogy of the heat flux relaxation time is to the driver's response time. So I won't belabor that. This is not something pulled from thin air. If you actually sit down and work out sort of the two-point correlation closure, and you basically, if you calculate the underlying phase-based density correlation, you realize the heat fluxes are just complicated moments of that. So the mixing rate for two-point correlation effectively defines the relaxation time in the mean heat evolution equation. Okay? And the upshot of this, right, is we look now at our telegraph equation. So we have a heat flux wave is kind of one type of fluctuation with a phase velocity, basically the square root of the diffusivity over the delay time. And then, of course, we still have good old Burgers bouncing along over here, and that has a pulse propagation speed, which is proportional to the size of the temperature perturbation. And, of course, you simply then ask, where do these two things cross? And interestingly, where they cross and where the pulse speed exceeds the wave speed is exactly where the effective diffusivity for the temperature perturbation goes negative. That's the point where overtaking occurs, and that's the basically where clustering instability occurs and you form the jam. And that's kind of a simple way immediately to get the jam. Interestingly then that the jam in this picture emerges as a secondary mode in the primary gas of avalanches. Again, that kind of always kind of thinking in terms of the kind of secondary mode picture. In terms of an analysis, basically you know it's a bit laborious, but you basically can do a perturbative analysis on this thing.
Is this stable to noise?
What?
Is this picture stable to noise?
We don't know yet. We don't know. That's an obvious thing to basically try to do the noisy telegraph equation. That's something that's on our list but has not been done. I was waiting for someone to ask that. So we go, you know, you can... Basically, the story goes, you do a standard stability analysis. There is a critical level of delay for the onset of instability. The scale of maximum growth then sets the pattern size or the staircase size, if you will. A bit complicated, but you can see your way through that. And when all is said and done, the characteristic scale then appears as the geometric mean of our small scale, the gyro radius, and basically the diffusion length in the presence of the background diffusivity. Basically, it's the background diffusivity chi 2 and our friend Tau, the delay time. The square root of this defines a length. This defines a length, and it's the geometric mean of these two lengths that defines the step size. In terms of standard parameters, a typical step then is going to be about 10 correlation lengths, which in the kind of the simple studies we've done so far is about right on the money. So it's a kind of natural emergent scale. Yes, sir?
So that's the distance between jammed tiles?
Yes. In other words, the the steps are the jams, and that length scale is the distance between jams. Okay? And
so this is all 1D, or?
Well, I mean, basically, the comment is that is all, basically, that is all one can do. But you're right, it is all one space, one time. And it's basically, the reason for that is the transport is evolving on time scales that are long, say, compared to a sound propagation time around the device. Right, so in other words, there is a set there, that's a sound transit time that's very short compared to even the propagation time of a few steps radially. Okay, so basically the idea is that that equalizes, in other words, it's kind of, how to say, propagates around very fast and equilibrates very fast relative to the transport time scale. That would be the justification. What I think would be a more useful thing would be to try and do a two-dimensional problem in the plane of R and theta. That would be the logical next step. That and essentially the noise exercise. So then to summarize, I think I'm about on time. Very, very capable. Strict leadership here, but ITER is in France after all. So we have a model for the E cross B staircase formation where basic ideas of is that of a heat avalanche jam producing a profile corrugation and an E cross B staircase, and the model is based on analogy to traffic flow, and the critical element that is the telegraph equation. The jam dynamics, the jam basically appears as a negative conduction or negative diffusion instability, and then from studies of that one can extract a kind of interesting, what I would call an emergent scale for this spacing of the step. And so far so good in terms of comparison with simulation. This analysis throughout this story has been set up in the context of heat transport. One could ask, what is the analogy for momentum transport? And for those of you who study turbulence, this question of the time delay really is a tip of the iceberg for a kind of a phenomenon of what is called elasticity in turbulence, a favorite of Uriel Frisch, I might add. We're kind of looking at the emergence of wave-like properties rather than, say, the sort of diffusion things in turbulence. And we've done some interesting studies of playing these games with momentum transport and its implication for zonal flows, but that's another thing, and I'll skip the history. One interesting thing on the subject of elasticity and turbulence, I was curious who was the first person to think of it, and or to even think of these wave-like phenomena in turbulence, and the answer is Lord Kelvin. So this is a copy of a paper of his from 1887, and you will note this thing appearing here in his discussion of waves in systems of interacting vortices, right? That is a wave equation, ladies and gentlemen, not a diffusion equation. And the characteristic wave velocity is the fluctuation intensity of the turbulent field. So in some sense, the idea of the telegraph equation has, shall we say, an interesting historical precedent going back to 1887. And this, as far as I know, was the first analysis of kind of secondary fluctuation in an ensemble of turbulence. Just a little historical amusement. So. That's all, folks.
So one of the questions.
is fluid.
Yeah.
Please.
In the table that you showed us earlier, you defined an avalanche as a transport event.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, you show us a simulation result where you have those red stripes. Sort of like high intensity, high heat burst.
Hang on. Like this thing, you mean?
No, it was horizontal. Previous.
Oh, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Sorry. Too much. We didn't even get to half the good stuff.
Yeah,
okay.
That's exactly right. So, with regard to your table, I was wondering if you can show a cartoon or a visualization what you mean by transport event, which then defines the avalanche. Can we now look at these things?
Yeah, that's a transport event.
All right.
Yeah.
So I can have a very clear visualization from simulation of the avalanche.
Yes, that's as good as it gets. The word transport event is a bit, it's a bit due to the, we all have our problems in life. In my field, there is an absolute fixation on linear instabilities. And they want to call the avalanche a mode. Okay, and so we kind of had to work on jargon to resist that. And hence the idea of a transport event.
But why do you use this negative conductivity? I mean, to me, it's a burst.
No, but the negative, you're right. No, but the negative conductivity, this simulation, you'll note there are no zonal flows.
What?
It was rigged. So, in other words, a zonal flow in this thing would be breaking it up. In other words, it would be a structure instead of going this direction, would be going that direction. The question is, when you don't cheat, you have a fight between the zonal flows and the avalanches, and that fight leads to the formation of this quantity, the staircase. So the question is to understand basically what sets the scale in the staircase. And that the scale of the staircase is the answer to how is the pattern formation problem resolved.
In that sense, then, the fight that you're talking about is really a competition between these two processes.
Yes.
Internal interactions and external drive. I mean, it's really what we would call self-organization. The system will self-organize and figure out the win.
Yes.
They're both there.
Absolutely, but I mean the question is to understand how that battle is played out.
That's
sort of, I mean, you can, by the way, to answer an obvious question, you can get out your thing, your quasi-particle picture or your envelope theory, all the usual cranks that we all know and love, and you can compare the secondary growth rate for zonal structures and the structures of the opposite symmetry. They're very close. I mean, in some sense, I wouldn't want to bet on that.
The growth rates are similar.
The growth rates are very similar. And I mean, I wouldn't want to bet on that. You know, I have to look a little deeper.
Okay. Any questions?